Another edition of Pittsburgh Pop with Rob Owen and Tim Benz here on Trib Live. It is your weekly slice of pop culture with the two of us. Rob, you, of course, can read him at TV Q&A and TV Talk. I'm daily at Breakfast with Benz on the sports side. The pop culture angle, the sports angle, very much intersect this week because it's Super Bowl week. Got the Eagles and the Chiefs on Sunday. No day in America do these two worlds collide more than on Super Bowl Sunday. Football fans want to watch for the biggest event of the year in the sport. People who don't like football watch anyway because of all the pop culture that melds with the sport, be it the anthem, be it the halftime show, be it the commercials. Rob, what are you the most interested in as we get ready for Eagles, Chiefs, and all the sidebars to Eagles, Chiefs?
Yeah, I guess I'm interested in the commercials, even though a lot of them are out there already. I have not watched them. I have decided a few years ago, once they started pre-releasing commercials, that I'm not going to play that game. If I can avoid it, I'm not going to watch it in advance. I'm just going to wait for the game and enjoy it there and come to it fresh. As far as the halftime or the pre-game entertainment, I'm less interested in that. I mean, I'm more interested in it now post Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake, just because I feel like I have to be. But you know, I'm not Mr. Music guy, so the commercials are what I'm in it for.
For sure, the zenith of the intersection between sports and pop culture with the Super Bowl was Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson, or maybe the nadir was that incident.
Right.
You can look at it from either end, and I think you could make a very strong case. Yeah, as far as the commercials go, the one that I saw that was released last week was Miles Teller and his wife drinking Bud Light while she was on hold with the cell phone. I don't know if you've seen that one around the internet yet.
Nope, haven't seen that.
Yeah,
I'll see it Sunday.
That one crossed across my feed on a number of occasions last week. But as far as the Super Bowl goes, I mean, there have been a couple of stories this week that have been associated with the broadcast end of things and the media end of things in football. The first of which is Tony Romo, who got this multi-million dollar huge contract from CBS just a couple years ago because they thought he was the greatest thing to hit sports broadcasting in forever since Dick Vitale started doing college basketball games or Howard Cosell first fired up Monday Night Football. I mean, the hype surrounding Romo that first year of his broadcasting was unbelievable. Now it's to the point where CBS allegedly, Rob, had to have an intervention with him to get him back on task and refocused on doing a better job of color commentary during CBS games. They could always get rid of him if they don't think he's good enough anymore. And maybe they will because they want to get Greg Olsen when Tom Brady takes over at Fox. That could be a play, but I think this is an issue of their own creation, the league's own creation, because coaches and sometimes fans and, you know, others in the football world weren't wild about his predictive skills, how he was able to see a play before the ball was snapped and know immediately what was coming and kind of tell the audience what was coming. They neutered him on that. And then once they did that, they realized, oh, there's just not so much substance there, you know, and this is a guy who's made millions and millions of dollars playing football. If we pay him a couple million dollars in the first few years of broadcasting, maybe he's not going to prep his ass off every Sunday for, you know, Steelers Patriots in September.
Yeah. And it should be said that CBS has pushed back at the allegations and said that no, that isn't why they met with him in the offseason. They're always meeting with their folks in the offseason. So who knows where the truth lies. But yeah, I mean, you could understand where if he felt like his strength was the predictive piece, and then if they did indeed tell him, cut that out, that he could just sort of be like, okay, then I'm just going to phone it in, right?
Right. And I think he has tried to work around that, but it's a lot easier to be a quarterback in the broadcast booth and talk about what is going to happen from the standpoint of just the calculus of everything that goes on in your brain. You can make that very equivalent to what that quarterback happens to be seeing. That's a lot easier to do in some cases from a trained quarterback's eye than to remember 53 players on each roster when maybe you're not intimately familiar with the second string strong safety on the Green Bay Packers.
Right.
You know, and then he also has the ability to quickly diagnose everything that happened on the play and break that down, which I still think he does fine. But there are some nuances to the prep that trained ears can hear that he's just not hitting a home run on. Now, another media issue that came up this week was in the wake of the AFC Championship game. Joseph Osai, he was the linebacker who shoved Patrick Mahomes out of bounds and basically cost 15 yards for the Bengals. The Chiefs kicked the game-winning field goal. They go on to the Super Bowl. The Bengals go home. Huge mistake by this kid. And CBS showed him crying on the sidelines a bunch of times before he got in the locker room. The media was asking him questions after the game was over. God forbid it was the biggest play in the NFL so far this season. God forbid they should ask questions. But Rob, Twitter was not happy with that. Twitter thought that the media was too mean to Joseph Osai. What do you think about the lines between where the media should be in terms of being polite and actually telling the story of what transpired?
Well, I think the media should obviously tell the story of what transpired. I think we can probably quibble over how many times to show him crying on the sidelines. But I think the bigger issue is just ignore Twitter. It's not the real world. It's not what real people think. It's a very teeny tiny subset. And it shouldn't have the import that it seems to have over the media sphere and the Twitterati in general.
Well, then I would suggest that to the NFL, because I think the NFL listens to Twitter way too much. I mean, up to and including...
Oh, I think everybody in positions of power, because they're the ones on Twitter, listen to Twitter way too much.
Yeah, and up to the point that they're considering implementing a new rule that's going to make it harder for players to tackle, the most fundamental element of football. They're trying to implement a new rule because some guy in Australia who played Australian rules football sent out a tweet talking about a specific kind of tackle that should be made illegal. We did it in Australia. Why can't you do it in America? And then everybody said, yeah, the NFL should do this to make it safer. Well, at some point, football is an inherently unsafe sport. Like, you can't tackle people to the ground and put them in bubble wrap at the same time.
I mean, I guess I would say to that, is that really Twitter, or is that more the larger issue of CTE, which, you know?
Well, this is actually got nothing to do with the head. That's the problem. It's got to do with legs. It's called a drop tackle, where you wrap somebody up and sort of fall on their legs to bring them down. Mm. And we've seen some broken ankles and high ankle sprains and things like that as a result. But it's like the way it's described is the most impossible thing that you could adjudicate on a snap-to-snap basis, and I don't know how they're going to fix it. And again, that's just Twitter having way too much of an influence. Now, there was... Go ahead, Rob. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, well, all I know is that according to a very surely unscientific poll, did you know, Tim, that Pittsburgh is 2023's best city for football fans, according to Wallet Hub?
Why is it that every year the Steelers don't make the playoffs, they seem to win this poll? Like, it's... They could win the Super Bowl and they're like third or fourth in this poll. When they're 9-8 and missed the playoffs, I feel like they win this poll every year.
They're number one in NFL fan engagement, which I believe that. They're number one in the number of NFL championship wins.
Well, they're tied with the Patriots. Yes. Yeah.
Fourth NFL stadium capacity, fifth performance level of NFL team. Let's see what else for Pittsburgh. 22nd average ticket price for NFL games, 17th NFL attendance, 97th minimum season ticket price for college football games. So I guess this is football in general, not just the Steelers. And then 117th performance level of college football teams, FBS and FCS.
Yes, it's quite the convoluted yet not at all scientific poll, like you said.
Yeah, I think Wallet Hub has a tendency to do those.
You know, a lot of that has to do, you know, football heritage here in the city. I get it. I think they did something similar, Rob, for hockey too, and Pittsburgh is second behind Boston,
right?
And Boston, of course, is, you know, them and Minneapolis are the two biggest hockey cities when it comes to participation in the U.S. And if you're looking at consistent playoff performance or consistently above 500, you got the playoff Penguins, who have never missed the postseason in 16 years, and the frequently playoff bound Steelers, even though they haven't won a playoff game in 6 years, they're never below 500. So they inflate that sort of playoff percentage thing that you were talking about.
Right.
So we can poke holes in that. But if the point is, yeah, Pittsburgh's a good hockey town in the U.S. and Pittsburgh's a good football town in the U.S., I'm pretty sure we didn't need the poll to tell us that. But it is
probably not.
It is kind of funny to me that when they don't win the Super Bowl, they tend to do better than they do when they win. But whatever the case. All right, let's get to, speaking of Twitter influence, for as much as the Grammys were being tweeted about last night, Rob, they did not influence me to watch. How about you?
No, you know, I am just not a music guy, and I never have been. Every now and then I'll feel like, oh, maybe I should just watch for the pop culture of it, but then I never do. Although I will say, since we were talking about Twitter, it was interesting looking at my timeline. There was as much commentary on my timeline, which, you know, take that with a grain of salt, as on the Grammys as there was on, I think, 90 Day Fiance or one of those TLC getting married type shows. So I got a kick out of that because it's just like, huh, the cultural influence of the Grammys is probably not what it used to be. And that's true for all awards shows.
Yeah, the Twitter buzz that I got on my feed was all about Ben Affleck wanting to go home. And yes, I can sympathize with it. I've never felt so connected to Ben Affleck in my life.
Right? Yeah. No. Not a Grammys guy, but that's all right. That's okay.
All right, Rob, I want to get to one show that I wanted to throw at you. I don't know if you've seen it yet. I saw it because there was some buzz about it late last week, and that is Kunk on Earth. It is a British show. It's a mockumentary show. Have you seen any of it yet on Netflix?
I have not even heard of it because Netflix never sent out anything on it to TV writers. And that's a whole other thing we can get to in a minute. But go ahead.
It's a British show, and it's basically about the history of the world. It's a woman who goes to all these historic locations like Mesopotamia, ancient Greece, ancient Rome. She's there. She's got a production team. And her goal is to tell the story of Earth. And she goes to some of the greatest historical minds in all of England and interviews them about very specific, very analytical, very theoretical ways about the rise of human civilization. And then she asks the world's dumbest questions. And she sets up every question like she's going to ask something very deep and meaningful. And then she takes a complete right turn into a different direction and has just left these incredible British intellectual, theoretical minds dumbfounded and stunned how to answer the question. And that's the gimmick for about a half hour, episode after episode. So I watched one episode. I thought it was funny. I'm probably not going to watch a second one. Like, you get the point. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No, I have not seen it. I am intrigued now to check out at least one episode. So maybe I will do that this week.
But it's very digestible. Like, you know, make some scrambled eggs for brunch and watch it.
Right. It does bring to mind, I don't know if you watched Saturday Night Live this week with Pedro Pascal.
I didn't.
He was the host. He was actually very good. He was very funny. I never thought of him as a comedy guy, but he did a fantastic job. And the writers were really on it. There were a lot of sketches that were quite well done. But the one that I got the biggest kick out of was, it was a quiz show format. Bowen Yang's the host, and it's questions about Hollywood, movies, TV, this sort of thing. And they start with a question that's, you know, from something that's been long standing from 20 years ago, maybe. Then they start asking questions about current things, and none of the contestants have any idea what they're talking about. and they're like, so can you give me something with a big star? And Bowen Yang's like, how about Nicole Kidman? And then he asks a question about two Nicole Kidman projects on Apple TV. And again, the cast contestants are just dumbfounded. They've never heard of any of these things. And it just shows how fragmented our environment has become, that, you know, my job is to watch TV and I've not heard of this Kunk on Earth show because Netflix never bothered to send out reviews, copies to critics or any press releases about it. So anyway, the fact that I'm familiar with it reminds me of that SNL sketch that was quite good.
Speaking of things I watched 25 years ago, like Saturday Night Live, how about Titanic 25th anniversary?
Yeah, that was on Sunday night. It was a National Geographic Channel special with James Cameron. And the big thing of it was he was trying to do an experiment because everybody says Jack could have survived on the door with Rose, and that he didn't have to die. And so he recreates the ending of the film with some poor suckers who get in a tank of really cold water and see if they manage to survive on the raft.
Okay, now hold on. The temperature of the water. Does that really come into play? Like, why does it have to be cold? Is there a theory like if the boat had gone down in Hawaii that they could have somehow survived together? If the iceberg had somehow made it to Hawaii in the warm weather of the Pacific and hit the boat, somehow those guys couldn't have survived in warm water? Why did it have to be cold to make the experiment happen?
Well, because the Titanic sunk in cold water.
I got it. Obviously. I got it.
And
yes.
I think the idea was that in order for Rose to survive, she had to be on the thing, which was not a door. It was a piece of a first-class cabin, lush, but not a door. That was his myth number one debunked, he told us at TCA. But I think the idea was she had to keep enough of her body out of the water. She couldn't be submerged in the water because he brought in hypothermia experts, and they were like, you have to have your body out of the water so much, otherwise you're not going to survive.
Okay.
So
they couldn't just tell the actors, have your body on the door. They had to freeze the actors.
Yes, they did. Although they controlled for that. They did not make it as cold as the North Atlantic because they couldn't do that to the actors. So they did some other variables in their testing, which whatever. But the ultimate result of these tests were that maybe, just maybe, Jack might have lived, but there's a lot of variables, and so it's kind of impossible to know 100% if he would have made it. And then he just sort of said, you know, if I had it to do over, I would make the door smaller, or the piece of wood they were on smaller, so that then people would not have the question.
That's probably a good read by James Cameron all these years later. Yes. Now, how about Joe Manganiello on Finding Your Roots, or is it Finding Your Roots?
I guess depends where you're watching. So Joe Manganiello, yes, from Mount Lebanon, Carnegie Mellon grad, actor, husband of Sofia Vergara, is featured on this week's episode. I think it's Tuesday night on WQED. And it's a fascinating thing. You know, finding your roots in these genealogy shows can be interesting, but this one is a particularly interesting thing. I wrote about it last week. And, you know, he's got some surprises on both his mother's side and his father's side. And I talk a little bit in what I wrote last week about what he learned on his mother's side. I don't give everything away on the father's side just because, you know, you want people to experience it for themselves. But it's one of the more fascinating Finding Your Roots discoveries, I think, in terms of what they learn about him and things that and about his family and his background and his heritage. It is nothing he expected. He said he and his family was taking bets on what they could have learned, and none of their guesses were correct. So it's a pretty good hour of television. It's Joe, and there's somebody else featured too. I don't remember who it was because I just zoomed through and watched the Joe parts. But yeah, I think if you like those genealogy shows, and if you're interested in Joe Manganiello, either of those things, it's worth watching.
Let's get to one more. There, speaking of native Pittsburghers, there was one on You're the One. Is that right?
Yeah. Are you the one? So this is a MTV show that has transferred to Paramount Plus, and I wrote last week about a local woman who is on the series, the current season that is airing new episodes. They release every Wednesday on Paramount Plus, and she is from the North Hills. She currently lives in Sarasota, Florida. Her name, I always want to get it backwards because she's got two first names. It's I think it's Taylor Kelly, but I keep wanting to call her Kelly Taylor, but I'm sure it's Taylor Kelly. Anyway, this is a show where you get sequestered in a mansion in the Canary Islands in this particular season, and a computer has matched up everybody in the house. So the computer has decided who your perfect match is. And then they have to go through and date each other until they figure out all the matches. And if they can get all 11 matches correct, they share $1 million. Although if a week goes by and they don't get any matches, they lose $250,000. So by the time I stopped watching, they were already down to $750,000 in possible award prizes. And she had not yet been matched up with her perfect match. So anyway, she's competing on that show.
All right, Rob, what do we have in TV Talk and TV Q&A this week?
TV Talk, we've got a local person on another reality show that I'm going to talk to later this morning. And TV Q&A, PBS NewsHour and some changes that have been made there that a viewer had some questions about. So that's the TV Q&A. And then this just in, Tim, it's breaking news. We've got Bruce Campbell. Do you know Bruce Campbell from Evil Dead? And I know him mostly. He was in a cult show on Fox years ago called The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
Okay.
He is bringing his Bruce-O-Rama show to Pittsburgh April 19th as part of a 22-city tour. It looks like he's going to be at Stage AE on the north side. He does interaction with fans. I think he shows some clips from his movies and talks about making them. So that is a thing that is coming in the next couple of months.
All right, we'll be sure to follow up on that, and we'll definitely follow up on the Super Bowl next week.
Yes,
when you come back for Pittsburgh Pop with Rob Owen and me, Tim Benz, here at Trib Live.